Next matter for consideration is A181338, State of Minnesota versus Rashad Ivy. Good morning. Both of you have been here before. With that said, I'll just remind you of your time limits. An additional 5 minutes is reserved to appellant counsel for rebuttal if you choose to use that. And also a reminder, please introduce yourself and the party you're speaking on behalf of before you begin your presentation to the bench.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Devi Axelson and I represent the appellant Rashad Ivy. This court in a published decision held that no departure was given and no departure reasons were stated on the record at the time of the original sentencing. The Minnesota Supreme Court has said in no uncertain terms, if no reasons for departure are stated on the record at the time of sentencing, no departure will be allowed. Thus, the district court's decision to grant a departure and two of the counts in this case was incorrect in conflict with Minnesota Supreme case law and should be overturned.
Mr. Axelson, isn't that the creed? You just summarized the law. Is that not the critical difference here? This court in Ivy 1 has already determined that no departure occurred, whereas the Williams, Geller, and all those cases, there was a departure with no reasons given.
Well, Thiemann, there is a presumptive sentence imposed, just like there was here. In this case, the district court imposed the presumptive sentence, ended up being incorrect about what the amount the presumptive sentence was. Same thing within Thiemann.
Hence, though, a departure occurred, right? In other words, it was a durational departure, if I recall, from perhaps 180 down to 60, or it was supposed to be 60. I can't remember the exact.
I think it was around 100.
Okay.
To 60, yes.
So the point being is the court, unbeknownst to the court and perhaps to counsel at that time, imposed a durational departure, and because the court didn't know it was departing, a durational in that case, did not give the reasons for it, that falls into the Williams-Geller law.
Well, I would agree that
here, the Ivy 1 has said that no departure, no dispositional departure occurred.
It's correct that the judge imposed the presumptive sentence at the initial sentencing hearing.
It was
incorrect about what the presumptive sentence was because it added on statutory factors that were not applicable to his case. So he did receive a departure. The judge just didn't specifically depart, didn't check the boxes, didn't announce departure reasons.
Because the judge didn't know, the judge was, if I read that correctly,
yep.
He did not know that he was imposing a durational departure, thought it was presumptive. But the point being is that's why Williams and Geller was invoked. It was nevertheless a departure, a durational departure with no reasons.
Well, it's the same thing in Thiemann. In Thiemann, there were departure reasons on the record. The judge did not understand that it was imposing a departure when it imposed the presumptive sentence. Turned out later that the district court was incorrect, as it was in this case, about what the presumptive sentence was. And the Thiemann court said, in no uncertain terms, in a very similar situation to here, that under Williams, the Williams rule and the Geller rule applies in that situation, and it should apply here too.
But in the difference, this is what I'm trying to understand in your client's position. This court has determined that there was no dispositional departure pronounced by the court. Hence, there was no failure to say departure terms by this court because it was not imposing a dispositional or durational departure, which is the Williams-Geller line of cases, but instead in error was imposing what it and the council thought was a dispositional statutory, but the court specifically said no departure. What I'm trying to understand is how does the Williams-Geller line apply to our case here if there was no departure, hence there was no reasons for departure, hence Williams and Geller wouldn't apply?
Well, I want you to add into your statement Thiemann. Thiemann is a Minnesota Supreme Court case. In Thiemann, they imposed the presumptive sentence. The judge had aggravating factors at its disposal in Thiemann, as the district court did here. No departure was stated on the record, and the reasons were not provided in Thiemann. Thiemann was a supplemental.
Factually, though, as I read Thiemann, there indeed was a departure, a durational departure.
There was a departure based on a misunderstanding about what the presumptive sentence was.
That's what I'm getting at is
yes.
Even that case, there's a departure. What I'm curious, have you found any cases in which the court did not impose a departure from the sentencing guidelines, whether dispositional or durationally, and I assume it would be durational, in which Williams and Geller applied such that on resentencing no longer was a departure allowed?
Well, Thiemann didn't realize they were imposing a departure at the time. The court here didn't realize it was imposing a departure at the time because they were relying on the presumptive sentence.
That's what I want to get at. This court's already determined it was not a departure.
No, I think this court said that the district court did not depart.
Correct.
But the sentence, in the way it was articulated, because the presumptive sentence was incorrect, imposed a departure, and that's why it remanded it back to the district court.
But wait a minute. We actually said in Ivy 1 that the court declined to depart.
That's correct.
Not did not, but declined. And, of course, the state's argument is simply this is a matter of semantics because we had a jury determination of 15 aggravating factors. So an upward departure and aggravated factors seem to be the same. How are we bound by Ivy 1?
Well, you're bound by Ivy 1 in the respect that this court held in Ivy 1 that no departure reasons were stated on the record and that no departure took place. And that brings this case exactly into Thiemann, and it brings it into the broad context of Williams and Geller, because Williams and Geller don't provide an exception. They just say, if no reasons for departure are stated on the record at the time of sentencing, no departure will be allowed. In Thiemann, even though there were departure grounds, as there were here, no departure is stated on the record in Thiemann. The Thiemann court did not depart in the same way that this court did not depart at the original sentencing, but the effect of the Thiemann sentence and the effect of Mr. Ivey's sentence is that the sentence was longer than the presumptive term, making it a departure. And in both cases, the district court went back at resentencing, tried to rely on aggravating factors that were not relied on at the original sentencing in order to get the sentence back to that durational departure.
Mr. Axelson, that's where I lose the connection with Thiemann, though. Thiemann, there was a departure. Unbeknownst to the judge, it was a departure. Durationally.
Well, here there is a departure unbeknownst to the judge because the presumptive terms that it added on of 48 months for each offense were not applicable. In the same way that the court in Thiemann imposed a departure not knowing that it was doing it and thinking it was imposing a presumptive sentence.
Thiemann, which cites Williams and which referenced in Geller, all refer to sentencing guidelines, durational departure, in other words, outside the presumptive sentence and does not state the reasons for it. Thiemann did that durationally, did not state the reasons for it. Ivy 1 has always determined that this was not a sentencing guidelines departure sentence. It was an attempt and a misreading of the statute for a aggravated higher presumptive sentence. And hence the court reversed and remanded for resentencing. So that's why I'm trying to understand how Thiemann would apply when Thiemann indeed was a departure.
Well, this case also was a departure based on the sentence that was imposed.
So what are we dealing with here? Are we dealing with the fact that there was, as a matter of fact, there was a departure, but the question is, was there a departure from the guidelines? Is that what we're arguing about here, the semantics of what a departure means?
Well, I think that this court, I don't know that, this court held that that the district court did not depart, but I think the key component of that.
Declined to depart.
What's that?
Declined to depart. I find that to be telling that it said it declined to depart.
Well,
and it had it had sufficient information in front of it at that time to depart. I mean, you agree with that, right?
That's correct. And so in Thiemann also they had.
That's why I'm concerned
They could have also used the departure grounds, but didn't do so.
But what I'm getting at is that's the reason I'm concerned on whether Ivy 1 is binding us because there was a determination, was our reasoning that the court declined to depart. even though there was a plethora of reasons to depart?
Well, I think this court is mostly bound by Geller and Williams, and Geller and Williams have a broad holding, and that's if no reasons for departure are stated on the record, at the time of sentencing, no departure will be allowed. So even if you forget about the first part about the exception you're trying to carve out, the holding of Geller and Williams is broad. And here, no reasons were provided on the record at the time of sentencing, so no departure is allowed in the future. That's the broad holding of Geller and Williams.
Well, Mr. Axelson, though, that's why I'm inquiring the holding in Williams and Geller, in every case I've looked at, including Thiemann, was a sentencing guidelines departure, correct?
In Bernard it is, I know, is that it's a departure.
My point I'm getting at is if the court had been successful in this case in reading that statute, and I think either one of the counsels cited an unpublished opinion where there was a similar sentence imposed on an earlier, I mean, the state did, the point being is that would not have been a departure if it had been successful. It would have been the presumptive sentence, adding the 48 months per the sentencing guidelines, correct?
Well, I just don't agree that part that Geller and Williams have a real firm holding that if
well,
no reasons
that,
are stated
but
for
in this
departure.
Case, this is a different case. I mean, it's almost as if there is, you know, you argued against the sentencing package in your brief, but in this case, it just, something doesn't seem right where the jury found all these aggravating factors, and had the court been aware that it was acting incorrectly, it would have, could have, and likely would have went ahead with an enhanced sentence.
It's a mistake by the district court, in the same way that in Bernard, a decision unpublished by this court, there was a mistake made by the district court. The defendant in that case admitted to aggravating factors. There's much discussion about the aggravating factors, but when the judge actually imposed the upward departure, the judge did not state those factors on the record, and I think that is the key component of Geller and Williams.
That departure was a sentencing guidelines departure.
What's that? That is correct, but there also are no cases that I've seen that follow the exception you're trying to carve out here.
What I'm getting at, I'm not carving out an exception, but I haven't seen an exception from the Williams-Geller. In other words, every one of those cases is a sentencing departure guidelines issue. We didn't have that here, and IB1 made clear it wasn't and said Blakely, Shattuck, none of those applied.
Yes.
And so the point being is if the court had been successful in its reading, it would not have been a departure. In other words, the aggravated factors make it with the multiple victims, it would not have been a departure even under the original sentence.
Correct. It would have been the presumptive sentence.
So that's what I'm getting at is there a situation, any case where a presumptive sentence is imposed or attempted to be imposed, which is what was done here, and Williams and Geller applied?
I don't believe any case cited by us or the state addresses that issue. I think that the Geller and Williams holding is very broad and that it is provided for a reason.
Let me follow up, though, then. If no case speaks to it, but Hutchins speaks to the realm that's available to the court, then at resentencing, because we did remand and resentence the Court of Appeals, and the court used two, I think, of those 15 jury-found aggravating factors to impose a departure sentence, what would affirmatively tell this court that's an improper sentence?
Well, Hutchins is a, you know, it's a published decision, but it's a published decision by the Court of Appeals. It doesn't address Williams or Geller and the broad holding of those cases. And I, you know, even though I was the attorney in that case, I don't remember specifically what the, you know, I think the grounds for the departure were stated on the record the grounds for departure were stated on the record at the time of the sentencing hearing. So that's why the sentencing package came into play for a different reason, because when a departure grounds are given but they're not adequate, then the district court can consider other grounds for departure, and I think that's in Williams and Geller too. But that's not the box of Williams and Geller, and that's not the rule of Williams and Geller that we're under here. When no reasons are given for a departure, Williams and Geller say in no uncertain terms that no departure is permitted on remand or at resentencing.
And I'm asking the same question, but the key you said there is there's a departure from the sentencing guidelines. to be Williams and Geller?
Well, the exact quote from Williams is, "If no reasons for departure are stated on the record at the time of sentencing, no departure will be allowed." It doesn't say at the initial sentencing. It just says no departure will be allowed. That I take away from that, no departure is allowed ever. So no reasons were stated for departure in this case, as this court held. No departure is ever permitted in any future resentencing, no matter how many times this case is sent back to the district court. Just quickly on...
...earlier to explain the rationale for this rule, and you stopped. What is the rationale for this rule?
You know, we talked about this in my moot argument yesterday, and I would just say to the court, I don't understand totally what the rationale for the rule. I think any policy argument regarding the rule would be resolved by the Supreme Court. All I know is that the rule is what it is. It's been around for a long time. There must be some rationale to justify it, maybe some type of, you know, I guess I don't understand the, you know, the rationale for the rule, but any policy argument regarding it would be resolved by the Supreme Court. I think the rule is what it is. In Barnard, this court said, you know, we have to follow the law, and that's what I ask you to do here, is to follow what the law says. When no reasons are given for a departure, no reasons for departure are stated on the record at the time of sentencing, no departure will be allowed. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. I'm Assistant Ramsey County Attorney Adam Petrus, and I represent the respondent in this matter, the state of Minnesota. With respect to the second issue in appellant's brief, the sentencing package doctrine, this panel is bound by Judge Werke's published decision in Hutchins. I'm happy to answer any questions this panel may have about Hutchins or the sentencing package doctrine, but if there are none, I will spend my time addressing what opposing counsel spent most of his time on, which is the first issue about the rule from Geller. Appellant's case is uniquely different from Geller, from Renault, and from Barnard. And whether it's characterized as an enhanced presumptive sentence or an aggravated sentence based on a statutory aggravating factor, the reason for the length of the sentences that Judge Joy Barcher imposed was clearly given on the record at the original sentencing hearing. Judge Klopaki, in response to your question to opposing counsel about the policy reasoning behind Geller, the best I can come up with is that Geller stands for that trial judges should not forget to do something that they should know about and that they should have done. But that's not what happened in this case. Judge Barcher did not make a mistake. Judge Barcher did everything she understood at the time she was supposed to do. And I think the Supreme Court's decision in Misquadens is especially compelling on this point, because the state of the law regarding the statutory aggravating factor at issue in this case at the time of appellant's original sentencing hearing back in May 2016 was at best unclear, and if anything, the existing authority, which is the Diggs unpublished decision, Judge Slider, that you referenced earlier, as well as Minnesota Statute Section 244.10 Subdivision 5AB, they supported the application of the statutory aggravating factor in the way that Judge Barcher applied it at the original sentencing hearing. And this court's decision in IV1 interpreting the multiple victims' statutory aggravating factor was either one of first impression or arguably one that changed the law. And as each of you know from your own experiences as trial court judges, judges are not expected to be clairvoyant and anticipate exactly how the law will eventually be decided on an unclear issue. And what happened in Misquadens, where the district court was given an opportunity on remand to consider whether aggravating factors were present to justify an upward durational departure, that's very similar to what happened here. Judge Barcher clearly provided a reason for the enhanced aggravated sentence that she imposed at the original sentence. That reason was subsequently invalidated in IV1 by this court. So Judge Barcher shouldn't.
So how how is Ivy One going to impact our consideration of this? Because we, you know, we're aware that Judge Barcher indicated at sentencing that she was taking into account all of the factors the jury found, but then when we have Ivy One saying, kind of referring to Geller and Williams.
Well, Ivy One didn't reference Geller and Williams.
They didn't reference it, but it indicates that.
And they had every opportunity.
They declined to depart.
Yes, no, I agree. It's exactly how this court characterized.
I'm kind of hung up on that word, declined.
I understand.
Chose not, I mean, just, yet it seems to be in contradiction because declined to depart, but yet she turned around and very emphatically stated on the record what she was doing, and everybody was kind of in sync with all of that.
I encourage you to review the more detailed transcript from the resentencing hearing in this case. I cite several portions of Judge Barcher's explanations on pages 18 and 19 of my brief. And what she explains there is that the overall or aggregate length of appellant's sentence was a primary consideration when she originally sentenced appellant for, in her own words, appellant's deplorable behavior, his extreme conduct in this horrible, horrible case. And hypothetically, if Judge Barcher had chosen to depart back at the original sentencing hearing based on her understanding at the time of the application of that statutory aggravating factor, well, then, in addition to applying those 48 months for each of the seven counts for each of the seven victims, the sentence would have been even longer than the extraordinary amount of 700 months because she would have had to depart upward on each of those sentences. And she explained at the resentencing that she thought that Mr. Ivy deserved every day in custody that she originally sentenced him to, but she also explicitly said on the record that had she imposed a departure on top of what she understood the enhanced presumptive sentence to be, the sentence would have been excessive.
So here's where I'm hung up on Ivy One. Should not Ivy One have made that distinction? Are you not relitigating that distinction to us in Ivy Two? That same argument would have been there, right?
For whatever reason, this court, when it was issuing its decision in Ivy One, chose not to address Geller. It had every opportunity to do so because Mr. Axelson raised that argument in his original brief.
Does that mean then that we should, that's not for us to decide, not for us to wade into, trying to say that these are semantically the same?
I can't decide which issues you address in your opinion, Judge, but what I can say is that this court knows very well when it is taking up a case on a sentencing appeal, how to instruct a court on remand to specifically impose a particular sentence, to specifically not exceed a particular amount, or to specifically not impose a departure. And this court did none of those things in Ivy One.
How would you expected Ivy One to have addressed Williams and Geller in this scenario?
I think by not addressing them, they gave Judge Barcher the authority to do what she did on remand. They're obviously well aware of the aggravating factors. They're obviously well aware of the fact that Judge Barcher chose not to depart or declined to depart.
So they didn't actually invoke Geller or Williams, but yet they didn't say that this is the same thing. So that kind of puts you on equal footing, maybe. That's not a question. I
see the point you're making, Judge Werke, which is that it didn't prohibit or it didn't explicitly allow what the parties' positions are here in Ivy 2. But I can tell you that in Geller, in Bernard, in Renault, this court specifically said that a departure would not be allowed on remand. And in Thiemann, there wasn't even a remand. The Supreme Court just handled it themselves. That's a huge distinction between Thiemann and what we have here. Obviously, this court felt different when it remanded for resentencing without any further instructions. And another key point about Thiemann is if you go through its language, at the end, the Supreme Court writes, "It is impossible to predict what the court would have done had it known that the presumptive sentence was 60 months." That's not the case here because we have a detailed explanation from Judge Barcher at the resentencing hearing on exactly what she was trying to do and why she didn't go above 700 months and depart because of her understanding at the time, because of an unpublished decision, and a statute which also went unaddressed in Ivy 1, authorizing the application of that statutory aggravating factor.
Mr. Beatrice, how would you have argued Williams and Geller applied, and how do you now today to the facts of this case?
They do not apply to the facts of this case. A reason for the enhanced presumptive sentence, or in the state's view, the aggravated sentence based on the statutory aggravating factor, was clearly given at the original sentencing hearing. After each of the seven consecutivized or stacked sentences at the original sentencing hearing, Judge Barcher explained and cited the statutory aggravating factor for the basis. At the end of the original sentencing hearing, on pages 21 and 22 of that transcript, she said that she was applying the 48-month enhancement to each of the counts. She gave a reason for the length of the sentences. And I agree, it's a bit of one of semantics about whether it's a departure or not a departure, but she clearly justified and provided reasons on the record at the time of the original sentencing hearing for the sentence she imposed.
Did the state argue that that was a proper presumptive sentence at the IV1? In other words, was that the contested issue, whether that, which obviously no other result, the Court of Appeals differed with that, but was that the state's argument that that was a proper dispositional sentence based on the multiple victim aggravating factor?
I'm going to answer your question, Judge, in two different ways. As I understand it, I was not present at the original sentencing hearing, but my reading of the record is that, as someone else pointed out earlier, everyone was in agreement that the 48 months was going to apply to each of those individual sex trafficking and solicitation counts. So yes, everyone agreed that would be a presumptive sentence. The state would have argued that, but there was no one to argue with because everyone was on the same page. That is the explicit recommendation that came from the probation department in their PSI, applying that statutory aggravating factor.
There's a difference between a aggravated presumptive sentence and a durational departure under the guidelines?
I think that's a distinction without a difference.
Why is that?
Because I think it's aggravated. So the reason that the presumptive sentence was 48 months higher on each of the individual counts was because of a statutory aggravating factor. The reason that an upward durational departure can be justified from the guidelines is because of an aggravating factor. Aggravating factors are the key. It's no different than if there was a different aggravating factor. Hypothetically, you know, in the privacy of one's own invading the space of a victim's privacy, for instance, where I believe there's case law saying that, you know, if it's a shared space between the defendant and the child victim, that it would only be in the person's room. It would not be in the entire house in which the defendant also shared. So if there was an invalidation of an aggravating factor after the fact, there were other aggravating factors that were available here. So I don't see how it's any different from that situation.
In a second and subsequent, would you consider that an aggravating factor?
I'm sorry, Judge, I didn't understand your question.
Subsequent. We have a number of statutes.
Yeah.
A crim sex, for example.
Yes.
A second and subsequent within a certain period of time.
Right.
Has an enhanced or aggravated factor to it.
Yes.
Under the statute.
Yes. I would agree that is another aggravating factor.
Okay.
Yeah.
But in some ways, then, these statutory factors are different than the guideline factors, aren't they?
They are and they aren't. I guess I don't really see any case law clearly distinguishing the two of them because, frankly, there's not a lot of case law on the statutory aggravating factors, which illustrates why Judge Barcher was a bit in a bind because she thought that the statutory aggravating factor applied. She did not want to go above the extraordinary length of 700 months by also departing, and so that she did not depart, and even though she thought 700 months.
If you had a second and subsequent enhancement factor, would a review of that be by abuse of discretion, or is it simply applying the statute and there's nothing for the trial court to do other than apply it?
Right. I mean, I guess after a trial in which there's no agreement on sentence, if she felt 700 months was too high, she didn't have to. It was permissive. It's not absolutely required. She could have departed if she thought there were substantial and compelling circumstances that did not justify a sentence of that length. Obviously, as the record makes plainly clear,
if it was all considered to be a presumptive, then she could have departed downward from that high number.
She could have, yes, very much so. And I would encourage this court to look at, I realize it's unpublished, the Van case that I cited in my supplemental authority letter. I know, Judge Klopaki, you joined that opinion. And that's just another example of how Thiemann can be distinguished. And it's actually fairly analogous to the situation that we have here. And if anything, Judge Barcher's actions were more understandable than what happened in Vann, because Vann involved a mistake about the defendant's criminal history score. Here, Judge Barcher was tasked with interpreting and applying a statutory provision of which there was no controlling authority. And I guess I want to point the court in the time that I have left to, I realize I'm not talking about the sentencing package doctrine, but there was a passage in Hutchins that Judge Warkey wrote that I think is particularly applicable here. And that's if this court, which is what I'm restating is my understanding of appellant's position, but if this court intended to limit Judge Barcher to only vacating the 48-month enhancement for each of those seven counts on remand, well, there would have been no reason to remand. This court could have easily done that. There was no discretion to exercise. There's no specific instructions to do that. And as I said before, this court is well aware of how to specifically instruct in many of the cases that appellant himself cites. And in the last minute that I have, I want to address one thing that's written on page 25 of appellant's brief, and that's what Judge Barcher did in imposing a sentence on remand, ignores the letter and the spirit of the sentencing guidelines. This is not a typical case, and it did not ignore the spirit of the guidelines. There were 15 aggravating factors. There were four separate aggravating factors on the two counts of which there was actually an upward durational departure imposed on remand. And already by challenging his sentence on direct appeal, appellant has reduced that sentence by 10 years. What he's seeking to do now is reduce it by another 22 years, seeking to cut that original sentence by more than half. Geller does not stand for some gotcha principle that when a trial court judge does everything she should based on the law that existed at the time of the original sentencing, an unfair sentence should result. I see that I'm out of time.
Thank you very much.
I just wanted to read directly from Thiemann, and I think it actually is the imposition of a presumptive sentence, because the court in Thiemann says, we do know that the court intended to issue the presumptive sentence and to allow it now to amend retroactively its reasons and depart from the guidelines is contrary to Williams.
But as indicated in the supplemental response, departure was requested here and aggravated factors were found by the jury. I go back to that because this appeared to be everyone's understanding, and we had the aggravating factors from the jury. And although respondent counsel identifies it as a gotcha situation, I have trouble getting my head around that.
Well, it's not a gotcha situation because the state actually, in the original sentencing, asked the judge to impose aggravating factors to justify the sentence, to justify those departures. And the district court didn't adequately impose those reasons.
Your reasoning, I mean, we need to have some sense here in terms of the guidelines. I mean, you started out with 700 months, and then it went to 581, and now under what you're arguing, it would be down to 381? I mean, that's a significant decrease in terms of the sentence that was intended, clearly intended by Judge Barcher's thoughts and comments.
Well, I'm just asking you to follow what the law says. Thiemann is an attempt to impose the presumptive sentence exactly like we have here.
But isn't the key difference, though, that it was not? It was an attempt, but that's the point, and that's why I was asking that question before. It was a durational departure without reasons.
But it was an attempt to impose the presumptive sentence. Here, the attempt by Judge Barcher was to impose the presumptive reasons, and in Thiemann they said, when you make that attempt and you're incorrect, you don't get to go back later and rely on the aggravating factors that were present, even though you had the opportunity to rely on those in the original situation. That's exactly the situation here. The district court imposed a presumptive sentence, just like it did in Thiemann, Minnesota Supreme Court case. And in Thiemann, they said you can't go back after the fact and apply reasons. Thiemann also said we're not going to predict what the court would have done. And here, the state has the benefit of the resentencing hearing. In Thiemann, there isn't a resentencing hearing. So the Supreme Court says we don't care what the reasons may have been.
Is it your belief that if IV1 had incorporated Williams, that it could have ordered resentencing utilizing those 15 factors? In other words, directed it similar to what Thiemann simply imposed
Yes, this court in Ivy could have said on remand, the district court can consider the 15 aggravating factors, and that actually was argued by the state in their brief to this court in the original Ivy case, and this court did not say that. Instead, this court used the magic words of no departure reasons were provided, and it brings it right into the context of Thiemann, and it is not a gotcha. And the same thing happened in Bernard. Bernard got a significantly shorter sentence than what everybody thought he was going to get, what he pleaded guilty to, what the agreement was. And this court says we have to follow the law, and they shortened his sentence because that's what the law says. Thank you.
Thank you. Matters were well briefed and well argued today. A decision will be issued in the statutory time frame.
Thank you.